very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio 2 here at Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In the next hour, we'll be asking how the last year has treated the world of bookselling. We'll ask if India's newspaper industry can adapt to the world of wireless technology.
There is a huge untapped market in the country, and that explains why the newspapers in India are growing.
And we'll also be checking in with a small Swiss firm that's combined the technology of a German sports car with old Alpine techniques to transform the simple ski. All that plus some great music right here on the next 60 Minutes on Midori House. In just a moment, we'll be joined by our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, who'll be bringing us a roundup of 2011's events in the world of the entrepreneur. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Christian Yeo.
Thanks. Three people have died and at least 75 injured after a shooting and grenade attack in the Belgian city of Liège. Witnesses say, as well as firing a rifle, the gunman also threw explosives. He's been named as 33-year-old Nordine Amram. Israel's prime minister has denounced a group of hardline Jewish settlers after they vandalized an Israeli army base in the occupied West Bank. There have been escalating tensions between the army and hardline nationalist settlers who believe they have a biblical birthright to live wherever they want in the West Bank. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has condemned their actions. Lieutenant Colonel Avital Leibovitz, a spokeswoman for the Israeli army, says dozens of settlers threw stones at a commander and his deputy.
The IDF sees this incident in a very severe manner. We are working currently to cooperate with other security organizations in the country in order to investigate this matter.
A downturn is sweeping through China's giant manufacturing sector. China's leaders fear unemployment amongst the country's tens of millions of poor rural migrants could threaten stability. China's export growth has slowed sharply, mainly because of low demand for goods in Europe. François de Rierigoyen from Manpower Group says their report suggests jobs will remain scarce.
The net employment outlook is 17% for China, which means that there's still a growth in the intention of hiring in China, but this is, you have to understand that this is much lower than in the past.
The French ambassador to the UN ruled out using military force in Syria in response to the ongoing violence against anti-Assad protesters. Gerard Aral said the international community must do everything politically possible to avoid Syria and the Middle East being set ablaze. France has led Western efforts to force Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to end the crackdown and has suggested a need to set up zones to protect civilians, the first proposal by a major Western power. Yemeni authorities say they've arrested six wanted al-Qaeda militants who were plotting to attack foreign targets and local government figures. The suspects are understood to include an al-Qaeda leader from a province that borders Saudi Arabia who's suspected of leading a cell that attacked Sana'a Airport in 2009. Earlier, around 10 prisoners, including members of al-Qaeda, escaped from a prison in the southern city of Aden. A pact between 26 members of the European Union to enforce stricter budget rules and win back confidence in the Eurozone will be finalised by March. 26 EU member states, all of them apart from Britain, agreed at a summit in Brussels last week that they would pursue deeper fiscal integration as part of efforts to tackle the continent's debt crisis. And scientists believe they've made significant progress in the search for the Higgs boson. They're trying to find the elusive particle amidst vast volumes of data from the Large Hadron Collider. Finding the particle would support Einstein's ideas on the working of the universe. A spokesperson for the team says they saw some tantalizing hints today. And that's the news at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Christian. Now time to take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Let's start with Europe. Lashings of heavy rain, high winds across much of Western and Northern Europe at the moment. And a word of warning if you are travelling across Western Europe over the next few days. A powerful storm is heading for us. Thursday into Friday looks like France may be impacted, perhaps southern Britain, Holland and Germany. Damaging winds likely, disruption to transport and even local power outages. Stay tuned to the media. In the meantime, Wednesday's City Outlook. London 7 degrees, windy with sun and showers. Frankfurt 7 too, very windy here with sunshine and showers. Vienna 8 Celsius and rain, Madrid 8 degrees, partly cloudy. And air travel delays for the end of the week across airports, especially in France, highly likely. North America, sunny skies for the US Atlantic seaboard through Wednesday. Fair weather also in Ottawa, Montreal and Quebec. However, rain is already gathering in the Midwest and will be heading in the direction of the Great Lakes and the northeast of the US. Here's Wednesday's City Outlook. In Toronto, it's 4 degrees, partly cloudy. New York City, 8 Celsius, with a bit of sunshine. Chicago, 10 Celsius and rain. And in Los Angeles, we're talking about 16 and sunny skies. Other world destinations for the next couple of days. South Africa, well, both Cape Town and Johannesburg, a lot of cloud here and a high chance of rain and some thunder showers over the next couple of days. Cool conditions too, but by the weekend, much sunnier and much hotter in these locations. And finally, Japan and Tokyo, mixed weather rest of the week, sun and some rain. You can expect highs here of around 10 Celsius. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
6 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosan.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propajala
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, live from Studio 2 here at Midori House in London. Well, every day this week, we'll be joined in the studio by Monocle's editors. We'll be asking them for a roundup of the highs and the low points of the year in their field of expertise. Today, I'm very happy to say it's the turn of business, and joining us live is Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. Lovely to see you, Jonathan.
You too, Emma.
With your roundup of the year, you've started off with a pick out a return to craft regions and strong made in brands as a key trend. What do you mean by this?
Well, it's something we've been pursuing quite doggedly in the entrepreneurs in the radio show, as I'm sure you'll know because you tune in every week, of course. So it's the idea behind this is that people have become quite logo disillusioned. People want to look beyond the logo. They want to know a bit more about the kind of storytelling and heritage of their brands. And so what we've been seeing obviously there's incredible craft regions the world over, whether you're talking about Scarperia metalwork in Tuscany or Okayama denim, but there's these incredible regions which became perhaps like neglected under globalization, and there's now been a real resurgence and return to it. So, for example, in the show, we've done a couple of reports on some great regions in the UK. We did one on Northampton shoemaking, and we did another one on Stoke-on-Trent potteries, both of those being really strong heritage regions that have been devastated.
So as well as just the fact that you're talking about manufacturing being located in a specific area, the region also has become an important question in terms of branding as well, is that right?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, on one level we're dealing with kind of micro entrepreneurs here, people who are, you know, savvy business people who are spotting opportunities in kind of breathing a bit more life back into a brand, back into manufacturing. On another level, you are starting to see a kind of regional brand coming together. I mean, quite explicitly in the case of last year, we had the launch of San Francisco Made, which was a kind of branding initiative in San Francisco to tie together lots of their designers and small-scale producers. This year was Copenhagen Made was launched with a very similar remit. And the idea is to kind of... the cities now need to work out, you know, what they're about, why, how they can package themselves up, how they can sell themselves to the world, and how they can compete.
And you're talking about regions as well, but you've also been concentrating on Monocle about the rise of what, you know, the so-called little man, and how big business might in fact, and its demise might in fact be the absolute saving blessing for the small entrepreneur.
Well, yeah, this is another thing we've been talking about a lot, is that there is this, I think people are quite disillusioned now. There's a sense of the kind of scale of the things that we've been dealing with over the last year, you know, the figures that we've seen, the kind of trillions in debt and the billions in embezzlement, there's a real distance from it all. And I think people want to return to something that's a bit less bloated, a bit more of a kind of, that you know, they want to know that their local ironmonger is going to be there tomorrow. They want to have a baker. They want to, it's this idea of going back to the things that are really important in life. So, you know, as big business, I think the bubbles burst around a lot of big businesses. People have kind of realised that a lot of the promise was quite hollow. And now it's a real return to kind of tangibles. And I think there's another element to this as well, that there's a lot of kind of anomie that comes from the way that we conduct a lot of our interactions and transactions through screens now. And there's been a kickback again with the whole global crisis, and people want to, there's a real space for kind of small business to take over some roles that big business was fulfilling before.
There's a lot of space, but as especially anybody in the United Kingdom has been reading in the last couple of years, there's been the death of the high street, and reports have come out onto how the high street can be have life injected back into it, and how these small businesses can get going. I mean, are there any initiatives, any formal initiatives that are being taken to try to make this happen? Because otherwise it just sounds like a lovely idea that's never going
to
happen.
Well, this is it, isn't it? I mean, these are great ideas to talk through, but it can end up just sounding quite idealistic and a bit fluffy. But no, there are some really exciting initiatives on the way. There was one recently in America, Small Business Saturday, which is actually an interesting one because it's supported by the big businesses, the big brands, the banks.
It's a big credit card company that
exactly.
does it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's American, American Express, and is one of the major sponsors. And they're really putting their weight behind it. Awareness this year went up massively. I believe it went up to 67%, up from 37% last year, which was the first year of launch.
Barack Obama went to a bookshop with his daughter, and everything was
all of that.
It was all tied in enormously with Black Friday as well. Its timing's great.
And it's interesting you mentioned Black Friday there as well, because there was this sense Black Friday is, you know, it's one of these events, you have huge sales and you can kind of artificially inject some impetus into the economy. But now it's the idea of Small Business Saturday is maybe a bit more of a considered approach, and one that could be more lasting and sustain economic growth in that way.
Now, one country, let's move away from a general look at business and entrepreneurship and the little business and the little man. There's one country that you focused on particularly this year, wasn't it? It was Turkey.
Well, yes. I mean, Turkey, I was actually lucky enough to go there. I was there a couple of months ago for their annual fashion week. So Istanbul Fashion Week, it's not really up there with Paris, Milan and New York. But
not yet.
No, but they're plucky. And I think their total budget for it is something like €800,000.
Right.
Which, you know, that's like less than one of the major shows.
A drop in an ocean.
So, you know, but there's things happening on the Bosphorus. I mean, they have these huge cultural events like the Art Biennale, they've got, which is up there with Venice and Miami, definitely now. And there's a sense that I think there's always been a bit of a hangover in Turkey that, you know, they've been creating their new economy in the ruins of this kind of fabulous Ottoman culture, and they're kind of, there was this looking backwards and slightly haunted sense of it. But then they're in this incredible culture that spans two continents, literally across the Bosphorus. You're in Asia, you're in Europe, and they've got this kind of hungry Asian economy with kind of European sensibilities towards luxury and fashion that's really unique, actually, in the world, and it's taking off and developing in a really exciting way.
The Turkish Prime Minister has been positioning himself very much towards Europe, knowing that the Middle East is obviously a place of political instability, so he knows that Turkey could in fact position itself brilliantly in terms of a political player. And also a sort of a bridge builder with the European Union. But this is luxury and design that Turkey has been focusing on as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think this is what they're really staking their claim to now. Because, you know, made in Turkey before, it used to be a bit of a dirty word. It was like made in China. But now there's been a process of really connecting the kind of end point consumer facing design and retail with this kind of huge hulking manufacturing base which they have. And why that's brilliant is because it puts designers directly in contact with manufacturers. Lots of Western designers will work with materials, but they don't work with the manufacturers necessarily. Whereas this new generation of Turkish designers really know the manufacturing principles inside out. And you have very integrated businesses like one of our favourite stores there, Bayman, the menswear store, which also has women wear line action. now. But they're completely integrated. They own their own workshops. There's another one, Armagan, who own all their own. They employ their own artisans. So it's exciting. Yeah, there's things happening there.
Jonathan, what an amazing year.
Yeah, it's been a good one.
Thank you very much for joining us. You're going to stay with us a little bit longer because we're going to stay with a small business soon, and we'll be exploring that. We're going to Switzerland to talk to a ski manufacturer who's won a very, very important contract, basing his skills on artisan tradition and combining it with high-tech BMW technology, no doubt. But before that, we'll have a little bit of music. The time is 15 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, and the music that we're going to hear is by Lady Hawk, Another Runaway. Lady Hawk on Monocle 24 and Another Runaway. Coming up on Midori House in the next half hour, we'll be asking what 2011 did to and did for the world of books. Stay with us.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world. In London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package. Looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics, Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. And I'm also pleased to say our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, is staying with us for our next item because it's just what you would be focusing on. Because all this week on Midori House, we're looking at Monocle's annual winter newspaper, The Alpino. And tucked away at the bottom of page 31 in our business section, there's just a few words about a specialist ski maker, and one in particular. Now, Simon Jacomet is from Zai, which is a company which has been just chosen as the official manufacturer of the World Alpine Ski Championships. And I'm pleased to say that Simon should be on the line for us now. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Simon, and congratulations on the contract for the World Alpine Ski Championships. You must be very pleased indeed.
Of course, we have been very pleased because we didn't expect it. We even didn't know that this exists, this kind of honor to be there. And we are happy also that the contract is made for 3 world championships.
And what exactly will you be making and being asked to make?
The reason to be there is because the organizers, they were looking for interesting brands with interesting stories. And as we are in ski business and don't have a story as mass producers, but it's a kind of different story. They were interested. The other reason was also to bring the event Ski World Championship to another kind of level, where they say it's more about an event and event where they are able to tell different stories.
So what exactly makes your skis different from any other manufacturer? I mean, this is obviously, not wishing to ask you to advertise too strongly, but obviously you were chosen for a reason.
Yes, I think the main reason is about the philosophy. And the philosophy is that We are not looking for trends and so on. We are just focused on the function of the product, and we don't have any limits concerning costs in the materials. We are quite open-minded in new ideas, and the value of the ski we are looking for is a different one, because it's also about longevity and making skiing as enjoyable as and easy as possible.
Mm. Simon, it's Jonathan here. I know you have some background in fine art, and I was just curious, does that influence the way that you approach ski design? Does it mean that you're more questioning about the principles of ski design, and you can maybe look beyond kind of traditional design and think outside the box a bit? Or how does that influence your business?
Yeah, of course it influences, and it even helps, because for me, in general, ski design is one of the worst designs, concerning all designs, and but it helps me in order to consider the shape of a ski as already something very nice, where you need to take care how you proceed and try to work with this beauty of the shape itself. That's one reason. And the other one is come up with new ideas which develop this shape of a ski to another look, as for example with the Netza we have with the hole in the middle, or the new freeride ski with a complete new tip.
Mm. And also, I know that you've got a long history in the business, and I believe you've worked for some of the big boys. You worked for Salomon for around 5 years, I think. And now, obviously, you've set out on your own, and you've had experience of being an independent. So, what was it like working inside the industry and seeing that side of things? Was it quite disillusioning, or?
No, first, as I had the opportunity to work in the industry, and I was also asked to do it, I was even not looking for it. It was really an honor, and it was a kind of dream coming through. But then experiencing how it works inside the business after a certain time, it was a kind of disappointment, because we were forced to make the whole time compromises concerning ideas and concerning the use of materials, of new materials, of design and so on.
Mm. Now, obviously, your skis, they are really at the high end of the market, and we're not talking about kind of cheap one-season skis here, really. Why do you think there's such a boom in bespoke? Why are people so hungry to really invest in these products at the moment?
I think one of the reason, and we also experience this different kind of reasons because we are very close to the clients, is that the clients are looking for real values, and they also are looking for credible stories. So we had several times clients coming to the factory, and they said, wow, this looks like on the website. And I said, yes, why should it look in a different way? And this shows me that I think often people don't really trust in what a brand maybe sells in the advertising and so on. And there we try to make a difference, to be close to the client and to really sell also the values we talk about.
You mentioned that you're close to the client, and that's important for your business model. Can you tell us a little bit more about the actual process of manufacturing a set of your skis and how you have the client involved from the very early days?
In the early days, as I was really looking for new ideas, in the first steps, you don't really involve the clients, because the first steps maybe you get results which are not better results, but I was always looking for different results. And then the first step is really to make a certain difference, but bring these differences to a positive result. And as soon as you experience something new for the product, you start to involve clients, you start to involve people you know. And sometimes if I'm testing in a ski area, I even ask people I don't know to test the skis and see what the reaction is. Sometimes also if I see somebody skiing, I say I would like to have a reaction from this from these people because they have a certain style. And sometimes I'm also happy if somebody says, I don't like the skis, because they say, I don't like the style certain people ski.
Simon, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because time has run out on us. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Simon Giacomet. He's from Tsai, the Alpine ski manufacturing company. You're listening to Midori House. And thank you very much indeed, Jonathan, for joining us. That was very kind of you.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Before we get the news headlines at the bottom of the hour, let's get a little bit more music. This is Brian Ferry and Roxy Music and Same Old Scene. Brian Ferry and Roxy Music on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. In the next half hour, we'll be finding out about the newspaper industry in India and the book-selling industry across the world. But first, let's get a quick catch-up with the world's headlines. Here's Christian.
Thank you, Emma. Three people are dead and a further 75 injured after a gunman went on the rampage in Belgium. Witnesses say the man who later shot himself fired a rifle and threw grenades at shoppers in a busy Christmas market in Liège. Israel's prime minister has condemned a group of hardline Jewish settlers after they vandalised an Israeli army base in the occupied West Bank. There have been escalating tensions between the army and nationalists who claim to have a biblical birthright to live wherever they want in the region. The international community is struggling to agree on a route to stabilising Syria, where fighting between government forces and protesters has claimed the lives of 5,000 people. The French ambassador to the UN has ruled out using military force in Syria, whilst Russia's foreign minister has rejected calls for political sanctions. Spanish national carrier Iberia says it's reached an agreement with 30 transport carriers to offer alternative travel plans for passengers ahead of strike action this month. The deal is aimed at minimising the impact of a pilot strike on December the 18th and 19th in protest at the creation of a new low-cost carrier by the company. Scientists believe they've made significant progress in the search for the Higgs boson. They're trying to find the elusive particle amidst vast volumes of data from the Large Hadron Collider. And French fashion house Dior is reportedly in talks with Belgian designer Ralph Simon to become the brand's chief designer. Dior has been without a lead designer since March after sacking Jean Galliano for making anti-Semitic remarks in a bar in Paris. A spokesman for the house declined to comment. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Christian. We'll see you at the top of the hour for a more full bulletin. But in the meantime, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour and a bit more music now. Aloe Black and I Need a Dollar. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. The time is 24 minutes to the hour, and that was Aloe Black and I Need a Dollar. Well, we stay with retail for the moment, where we say that 2011 has been a tough year for retail in many areas, but that's arguably nothing new in the world of books, with digital technology and internet retailers still snapping ever more keenly at the heels of the high street shop. It has once again been a year of profound change. Well, this year's biggest book trade conference, Future Book, is currently underway, and to talk about what this year has been like for bookshops and to look ahead too at what might be in store in 2012. I'm very delighted to say I'm joined by Benedicta Page, who's the news editor from The Bookseller. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Benedicta.
Thank you.
I mentioned just then that the book world has been experiencing profound change. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It's in the heart of an enormous change, a really revolutionary change. As the digital technologies come in on both the publishing side and the retailing side, of course, and e-books really take off. They've really been taking off this year in the UK, as they have already in America, and they're becoming a huge part of publishing. And it's really forcing publishers to think again about everything that they do, to really think, what is a publisher about? How do we bring stories to people, and do we have to change really the heart of what we do?
And when you mean, you know, re-examining publishing, I think at this fair today, the editor of Faber has said that it's less about publishing and more about means of reading and writing.
That's right.
That's a very specific split, or very specific distinction to make. What does that mean exactly?
I think what he's really talking about is this idea that you have to go back to the basis. You have to think about, for example, if it's a novel that you're publishing, you have to think about story. You don't think about a book or an ebook. You think about your story and all the different ways in which it can reach readers. So that could be through a virtual reality game, even. It could be, you know, through a very complex app. It could be through what we're now calling long form narrative, which is long form narrative is what we've always called a book up to
right.
now.
So hang on a second. So you're So the book is actually having to be renamed.
Well, we're rethinking what a book actually is, yes, and what, because it's all about how you reach your readers.
Right.
And some readers, of course, will still want to have a physical book, but other people, habits are changing so deeply. People will want to consume books in very different ways. We're not just talking about the difference between an e-book and a printed book, although that's very, very important.
It is very important, because it's the physicality of the action of reading, which is profoundly altered at that stage.
That's right.
And I think that lots of people, and especially if you consider, you know, where you are at the moment at a publishing house, which in Monocle magazine is very much a magazine. The fact that people are having to rebrand the concept of a book might be worrying to lots of people who have possibly a more romantic idea of what reading is all about.
I don't think it should be. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of publishers have been worried as well, because they're realising that everything that they do is really in the midst of change. But I think there's also a great optimism, also a great feeling that we can achieve new things, we can be creative in new and different ways, and that, you know, the changing environment does offer people that. It doesn't mean that the old form of reading has to disappear, and lots of people are, I mean, you mentioned obviously James Daunt at Waterstones is very keen on the beauty of the physical book and the printed book, and I think many people love that very much, and that's not going to go away. And, you know, the smell of the paper, and, you know, the feeling as you turn the pages.
The real feeling that you get when you turn a page.
Indeed, that's not going to go away, but there will be other things that will come alongside it.
Now, one of the things that James Daunt has done this year, when he took over the ailing British train Waterstones, is that, I mean, for anybody who's been anywhere near Marylebone High Street in London, anyone who's visited Daunt Books will actually remember the incredibly vivid experience you get in a very beautiful, immediate, cosy, intimate bookshop, which encourages you to browse and to read. Daunt is now taking over this enormous chain, and one of the first things he's done is got rid of the Pilum High culture, which was, you know, the buy three for two and what have you.
Yes.
How do you think that will pan out? Do you think it'll work?
I think, you know, it's a very strong idea, because a lot of small independent publishers have been doing well, even though it's a very difficult climate at the moment, because they have that personal touch. They have a big range of books. They really care about the books and can talk to customers. And that's the kind of culture you have in James Daunt's own small chain, Daunt's. And that's what he wants to bring to Waterstones, which he's now at the head of. So that will really offer a very different kind of experience from the experience, obviously, of going online, where you look to buy books cheaply, etc. This will offer a very, very different kind of experience. And I think that's what is needed to get people back into high street shops, which have been suffering.
It might get them into the shops, but there are sort of recurring arguments at the moment, or recurring reports that people are going into the bookshops and they're doing their browsing and they're deciding what books they want to buy. Mm. And then they realise that having experienced that wonderful shopping, retailing joy of talking to someone who knows what they're doing and what have you, they then go down to their, well, they either, you know, they go home, go straight on the internet and order it online for 20, 30% cheaper.
I know.
Is that a very real problem?
I think it is. I mean, this idea that the bookshops become the showroom and you go in and you draw it and then you knit back home.
And the money goes away from the bookshop itself. What
yes.
can you do about that?
Well, I think you have to be quite creative. You have to build a real connection with your customer base, with a community base. You have to become a really important central part of the community. And holding live events where you're offering something different and the author comes and he signs the books and you sell the books there, that's a very strong part of what successful independents are doing. They're having good, strong author programs where, you know, lots of great authors come and talk about their books. You have to really build that sense of the bookshop at the heart of the community so that people aren't just seeing it as a sort of anonymous showroom where they can go and have a peek around and then, you know, go on their mobile phone and order a copy from
what
an
so
e-retailer.
Many people do now.
They do, indeed.
I mean, we were talking about people who are, you know, browsing but not buying. But then also there is this 2011, for me, in many ways, was the introduction of the Amazon Kindle Fire, where you suddenly have a really, really cheap digital format by which you can download your reading material.
Mm.
How do you think that's going to pan out in the next 12 months? Do you think Amazon will suddenly become the only place where people get their reading material? Or, I mean, what's the effect going to be, basically?
Well, you know, in some ways it's the great unknown. And we mustn't forget that, you know, there are lots and lots of other devices also flooding onto the market, like the Kobo, which is, you know, on sale at WH Smith's now. I mean, there's a plethora of places where you can go more and more. And so people are reading more and more.
But it's the cheapness, though. It's the immediacy and the cheapness.
Yes, but there's an argument that people will then read a lot more than they used to because they can lay their hands on. So you may be growing the market, even though you're getting, you know, maybe the author's not getting very much for each sale, because the argument is because you can sell so many more titles to so many more people and actually grow the whole habit of reading, that it may still end up a sort of viable living for the various people, and most importantly, the authors, of course, who are involved in it.
Now, we've been concentrating very much on the British and the Western market.
Mm.
In a moment, or later on in the programme, we're going to be talking about how India is dealing with the fact that all its newspaper journalism is still very much paper-based.
Right.
So let's take this idea of the global book-selling market and say, OK, what's happening in other countries and how are other countries book-selling markets changing in this past year and next?
Well, I think it's very much fair to say that e-books as such are an English language-dominated phenomenon. So it is still all about the UK and America, really, at the moment. But that is changing. And certainly all the European countries are developing their programmes, and it is becoming more and more international. In China, the big online retailer, it's called the Chinese Amazon sometimes, Dangdang, has just announced that it's going to start selling ebooks in the early part of 2012. So it's certainly just a process of development. And often, you know, as particularly Amazon launches its sites around the world, where that happens, that's a huge boost, obviously, to ebook publishing and ebook consumption in those countries. So it's a sort of bit by bit approach. At the moment, it's very much English language, but that's all changing all the time, as everything is.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's something that I've just read about China, and you were mentioning China and the introduction of Amazon. Is this enormous surge in self-publishing websites where readers pay a tiny premium for the latest instalments? We're going back to the times of Dickens here. Being a spectacular success in China, where you don't actually need a publisher anymore.
Right.
If you're a successful author, you can just put chapter 3, chapter 4, however many times you like. What's going to happen there?
Well, that is one of the other, you know, big shifts. Are people going to bypass publishing altogether and go direct to their authors? These are one of the issues that's up for grabs at the moment. I mean, I think people will perhaps still find that having a publisher as an intermediary to sort of sift quality and market the book and do all the things that publishers do to the book, which is a lot more than some people seem to think, that is still going to be important. But there are many other ways. I mean, you know, Amazon itself is publishing titles now. It's a bookseller, and yet it's a retailer, and yet it's becoming a publisher. All these boundaries are changing. And so just as, you know, self-publishing used to be very much looked down upon, it used to be perhaps thought of as a thing you did if you couldn't get your book published by a reputable established publisher. Now that is changing. It is seen as an opportunity that people can take to go direct to readers. So it's all up for grabs.
Benedicta, very briefly, time is running out on us. Gaze very quickly into your crystal ball and tell us what's going to happen in 2012.
Oh, that's a difficult one. The digital surge is just going to continue. People are predicting we'll hit a tipping point where it's 50-50 digital print, perhaps 2020, perhaps 2015, that the deadlines are coming down the whole time because it's moving so fast.
Benedicta Page, thank you very much indeed for joining us. She's a news editor from thebookseller.com. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24.
Christmas has come to Midori House, so relax, throw a log on the fire and curl up to Monocle 24 for the whole winter season.
God jul fra Monocle 24.
Feliz Natal da Monocle 24.
圣诞快乐 从 Monocle 24.
Joyeux Noël de la part de Monocle 24.
Både Karachan Kivan a Monocle 24.
Hei Diola, så vi Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 より Merry Christmas.
Frohe Weihnachten von Monocle 24.
Buon Natale da Monocle 24.
Feliz Navidad de Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 より Merry Christmas.
Hyvää joulua toivottaa Monocle 24.
Selamat Hari Christmas daripada Monocle 24.
Καλά Χριστούγεννα από το Monocle 24.
Merry Christmas from all at Monocle 24.
And the time is 11 minutes to the top of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Emma Nelson. And we stay with publishing and print for the moment, but of a more immediate and ephemeral form, because it's no secret that print media around the world is floundering. And there are dire predictions that newspapers may well die out in decades to come as advertising drops and people turn more and more to the internet. Well, that at least is the story we appear to be getting in the West. However, in developing markets, things appear to be markedly different. For example, India, in particular, has a buoyant print media market that's growing because literacy rates seem to be improving. Aarti Bettigeri reports from Delhi.
By any measure, India's newspaper market is huge. 110 million papers are sold each day. That's 20% of all dailies sold worldwide. And Shailaja Bajpai, media writer for the Indian Express newspaper, says the market is growing and fast.
The reason why the market is growing is because newspaper penetration in India is very, very low. All print publications included, magazines, newspapers, and any kind of print publication included, the total print penetration in the country is around 30%, and that despite the country's literate population, it is almost 70% people who can read and understand, you know. So that explains that there is a huge untapped market in the country, and that explains why the newspapers in India are growing. So there is a huge market that remains outside the scope of the markets that the Indian newspaper, Indian print owners have been serving. So that's precisely the reason. And also within the metros, you know, so far people were reading like, you know, one newspaper or two newspapers, but there are not a lot of new varied products now. There are magazines within the newspapers. People have started diversifying. So there are like general newspapers and then, you know, premium newspapers and stuff like that. So there again, you know, within the markets that may seem saturated, there also the owners are launching new products and the readership is constantly growing.
Newspaper circulation figures across the board are growing at around 5% each year. But the real growth is in regional language newspapers. The biggest selling paper is the Hindi language broadsheet Dainik Jagran at around 16 million copies each day. In English, it's The Times of India. With a circulation of more than 7 million each day, it's the largest selling English language daily in the world.
English is a very, very small segment, though they call themselves the national dailies thanks to the fact that they come out from Delhi, which is the national capital of the country, and Bombay, which is the financial capital of the country. English readership is very, very small. It would be less than 20-25%. The rest is accounted for by the so-called vernacular newspapers. Hindi, in a way, is the national, you know, the Hindi newspapers should be called the national newspapers. They always argue this. They always contest the fact that the English guys are called national newspapers, whereas it is they that serve the maximum number of readers across languages. There are several other language newspapers like Tamil, Telugu, Marathi, Malayalam, Bengali, Odisha, and English is not growing as much as these newspapers are because they serve the markets which are untapped. The English newspapers are largely concentrated in the metros and class one towns. They've already covered like 90% of the market. 90-95% of people in these markets do read newspapers. So now they're trying to expand into newer markets. So going back to Times of India, they tried acquiring a regional newspaper and, trying to sort of get into a regional market down south. So that's what, that's an opportunity that the English newspapers are vying.
Based on the impressive figures, it might be tempting to try to get a foothold in the Indian media market. But beware, there are plenty of obstacles and pitfalls. Possibly chief amongst them is the issue of distribution. Unlike more evolved markets, which have formalised and centralised distribution methods, in India each centre has its own system and its own players. It's a difficulty that one of India's newest English language papers, The Sunday Guardian, found out when it launched 2 years ago. Assistant editor Prayag Akbar says it's been difficult to build a readership.
To get it out in a city of 15 million people, to get the publication out on every Sunday morning has been something of an ordeal. Delhi is a huge, like even geographically, it's very sprawled out. So, there's a lot of different vendors and hawkers you have to deal with. You have to set up a system that can provide our publication in every part of the city. So you need a huge framework of people on our side, non-editorial staff, to look into something like that. You need to build sort of connections with the hawkers and vendors, and those things come over time. Those relationships come over time. They have a lot of say in who sees a newspaper. There's a lot of interest also from abroad. Like a lot of foreign publications want to invest in Indian publications, but they can't because we have a sort of FDI. Each newspaper has to be owned by an Indian, basically. It has to be owned by an Indian entity. And there's only a certain amount of capital you're allowed to take in from abroad. So I think one of the most interesting developments of the last 6 months or so has been the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have created these blogs, India Inc. and India Real Time. I think the Wall Street Journal one is called India Real Time. So both these publications, because they can't get involved in the print market in India, but they recognize that there is like a growing market for English language publications, so they've taken to the web. It's good to see that it improves the quality of journalism in India and the sort of the level of discourse.
Another issue plaguing Indian newspapers is somewhat of an image problem based on the bad behavior of some, specifically the issue of paid news.
Paid news is actually the term that we've used now to describe a pretty cynical form of journalism, in the sense that like a lot of publications all over the country actually were taking what amounts to bribes for publishing positive stories on certain political parties or certain, before elections. And they were taking huge sums of money and sort of using this and justifying it as like, to cover editorial expenses and things like that. And the Election Commission actually cracked down on it. It's really worrying. I think now it's moved into a features journalism space, and now you don't see that much of it in the political side because the Election Commission is involved and no politician wants to be seen doing that. But I think it's still very much present in the feature space, and you'll find like plugs for movies and shampoos on the front page of the feature section of a newspaper. I find it like pretty reprehensible because there's nothing. I mean, you're not being a journalist, and you're publishing a pamphlet in a sense.
And that was Monocle's Delhi correspondent, Aarti Bhattacharya, looking at the growth of the newspaper in India, and in particular, excuse me, the regional papers. Well, that's all for today's edition of Midori's House. The show was produced by Dawn Trump, research by Alberto Pickers, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Hugo McDonald's here in just a few moments with the latest design show. Our colleagues on the Monocle Daily will take over at 2200 hours GMT in London to kick off the day in Asia. Here's one last song to play us out, though, on Midori House. Crying for Hollywood by James Yule. For Midori House and me, Emma Nelson, goodbye.
Today.